welcome to another episode of the Dad's Army podcast, episode 61 to be precise. We've got a commentary episode this time around. It's Sons of the Sea, one of my favourite season 3 episodes, and one of the very few episodes where you see the platoon messing around in boats. And I don't know why, but anytime there's a boat in an episode of Dad's Army, I automatically seem to start smiling. Perhaps the image of a bunch of old men in a boat, armed to the teeth, is just inherently funny to me. I'm really not too certain. Anyway, for this particular commentary, Oliver and I were joined by Mervyn Cumming. Now, Mervyn is an established BBC director. He's directed EastEnders, he's directed Coronation Street, Brookside, El Dorado, Families, Crossroads, A Family Affair. I mean, his CV really does just go on and on. And as those of you who listen to the podcast fairly regularly know, Oliver is an independent filmmaker. Indeed, I met him at a screening of a particular documentary that he'd made about Frank Williams called Dad's Army and Beyond a couple of years ago. Now, Oliver's doing some work with Mervyn once again. He's actually doing another documentary about Dad's Army. And during their very hectic filming schedule, I was really pleased that Mervyn was able to sit down and just commentate on an episode of Dad's Army with Oliver and I. Now, because Mervyn is a director, of course, he was able to provide a slightly different insight into the episode to that which Oliver and I usually do. I mean, a lot of my comments are usually speculation. Oliver is a little bit more informed from the production side of things, but of course a fully fledged BBC director was able to give us an insight into various elements of production that we simply would not have been able to discuss in so much depth without. So Mervyn, thank you very much indeed for agreeing to join us. Now, stay tuned at the end of this commentary because you've got an interview with Mervyn that Oliver conducted probably about 2 years or so ago now when he was filming Dad's Army and Beyond. He talks all about what working with Frank Williams is like now, and clearly not just lots of stories about Frank when he was on Dad's Army, but he is still working, Frank, and Mervyn provides a really interesting insight into what it's like working with, well, for Oliver and I, a complete legend. So, without any further ado, in a moment you'll hear a countdown, 3, 2, 1, play, and after you hear the word play, press play on your DVD or on your computer, however it is you're choosing to watch this episode, and you'll hear us commentate on it more or less in sync with the episode. Don't forget to send us feedback as usual, james@dadsarmypodcast.com or oliver@dadsarmypodcast.com. Thanks again for tuning in and enjoy the commentary.
You all want that, won't you, Wilson?
Oh, yes, yes.
Killers of the rowing boat.
Mm-hmm.
15 feet long, 5 foot beam, 4 oars, seaworthy condition, blah, blah.
Yes, well, that's not going to be very much good, is it? I mean, we can't go rowing about in the sea in wartime.
It isn't actually on the sea. It's about a mile upstream on the river.
Oh.
Anybody can go and look at it if they want to. Mm. Now, look here, I think we'd better get down to this bit. Wait a minute. I've had an idea.
Now, be careful, sir. Please, be careful.
River patrols. That's it, Wilson. River patrols. Half a dozen determined men, armed to the teeth with a boat. They could play havoc with the Nazis if they got a foothold. What? Do you see it? Swift, silent patrols, hitting the enemy where it hurts most, then disappearing into the night, quietly without a sound, silently cutting through the water. Muffled oars, of course.
Three, two, one, play. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Dad's Army podcast, and it's another commentary from us this time around. I'm joined, as always, by my trusty, I don't know, I was going to use the word sidekick, but you'll probably punch me. So anyway, Oliver's here. Hello, Ollie.
Hello, James. We're back, and we're also joined by a very special guest. We're joined by a man who has notched up nearly 500 episodes of drama credits to his directing career and is currently working on a brand new Dad's Army documentary. It's the one and only Mr. Mervyn Cumming.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us, Merv.
Pleasure.
And We're here today to talk you through... this was a request, wasn't it, James, from a listener?
It was indeed, yes. I'm afraid I can't remember who it was. Yeah. So thanks for that. But yes, there was a chap who left a request on our website asking us to commentate on Sons of the Sea. So whoever you are, this is for you.
And this was the final episode of the third series, so the first episode that was made in colour.
First series that was made in colour?
First, yes, thank you. Thank you very much. When was it shown?
This was shown on the 11th of... No, it wasn't.
The 5th of December.
Was shown on the 5th of December, 1969. And it feels like an appropriate moment to point out and remind you listeners that we can't edit.
No, this is live. It's all good fun.
We normally edit out our flats. We're not able to on this occasion. So, yes, this was recorded on the 5th of September, 1969. And it was actually broadcast on the 11th of December, 1969. So... a week or so, just over a week, or just under a week, between recording and broadcast. What kind of pressures would that have put on the crew, Mervyn?
Well, I would have thought that would have been very tight, because I don't know at that time how much editing was done, but there must have been some done, and that's pretty tight, because there's a lot to do with editing, and in those days, editing was much cruder than it is now. My editor once at the BBC showed me an editing block from the days of 2-inch tape, and it was an enormous piece of equipment with a great zigzag cut point, because the sound was always at a different point from the vision.
Right.
He also produced out of his cupboard a pepper pot, which was full of iron filings. So when he'd made the cut and cemented it together, he then had to pour iron filings over it so that it didn't flash on the screen.
Wow. Whereas we've got to turn our mobile phones off to make certain there aren't interference. Presumably that was magnetic tape or something.
Technology has changed. What's it like... you've directed with a live audience. What's it like actually... how much waiting around do the audience have to do on a live comedy show while... the technical things happen?
Not a great deal, because the sets are usually adjacent to each other in story order, and people are the cameras are cleared to go to the next set, so you can normally run fairly continuously. But if there are any big makeup changes or costume changes, then obviously everything has to stop. And in comedy shows, they usually have a warm-up man who comes on and keeps everybody jokey and happy while that goes on.
And in this case, the first warm-up man actually assigned to Dad's Army ended up getting a part with it, because Bill Pertwee was the warm-up man. And they said, well, we'll give him a small part as the area warden, and the rest is history, and he's become a Perry and Cross staple.
Really?
Just going back to the episode, or starting with the episode, should be. This is one of the episodes that opens with an office scene, which are quite few in number, because normally they open with a parade or a lineup of some kind. And again, the main protagonists, Mannerin and Wilson, are in civvies, so it's not immediately obvious that it's wartime. However, they're talking about using a boat. And of course, Mannerin's very excited about this, because it gives him a whole lot of new options as far as he's concerned. Now, one might question how sensible putting a bunch of pensioners in a boat and arming them is, but I guess that's the whole point of this story, is it not?
It's quite a good one, this one, because it's still early days in the show, and so the whole idea of the Home Guard forming, it's still a very fresh idea, so they're still trying out new things. It's not really all that long... I mean, here they are, look, they're still in the civvies here. It's not that long ago we first saw them with brooms with knives on the end, you know, so it's still quite early days of the show.
I would be very nervous if ever I got into a boat with John the Measurer. Because I worked with him once or twice. He was exactly like his character.
Really?
He was so vague, it wasn't true. When we were rehearsing in London for the play we were doing, he couldn't find where we were rehearsing. So he went to a school opposite the rehearsal rooms and went round every room, every classroom, opening the door and saying, oh, sorry, and then moving on. So it was absolute chaos. And then when we realised how vague he was, the PA on the show got him his train ticket to Leeds and got a taxi for him to go off to get there on time. The one thing she forgot was that in those days the train broke in half at Doncaster. And on the evening that he was due to arrive, we had a walkthrough in the studio, and he wasn't there. And the stage manager had to read in for him. And halfway through the show, I got a phone call to reception, and this voice said, Mervyn? I said, yes, John, where are you? Hull? He got on the wrong part of the train. So he was incredibly vague in real life, but a lovely man, great fun to work with.
It is fascinating when you look at how characters develop over a long period of time. And of course you've got Dad's Army running for 9 years, and you've got the creation or the formation of the character within the writers' minds at the beginning. But I wonder how long it is before the writers start writing for the actors, and presumably when an actor knows their character really well, it's easier to direct them.
Oh yes, very much so. I've done a lot of long-running soaps, and when I first started, I said to my supervisor when I was training, how on earth do I direct these people, because they know much more about the show than I do. And he said, no, direct them, and direct them hard, because they love to be directed. But when it comes to character, they know their character. Which was very interesting, and it worked fine.
How you were, by the time Dad's Army was on, I think you were doing a lot of stage managing at Yorkshire Telly. But I mean, in terms of how big this show was at the time, how big was Dad's Army in terms of popularity?
Oh, enormously popular. Yes, I mean that must have been its first run, was it? Yeah. But it was incredibly popular. And a lot of people in the business, which was interesting, in the business watched it, right, because they thought the quality of the comedy and the quality of the direction was excellent.
What was it that was so unique about it? I mean, it's, well, I think you can look back, you know, 40, 50 years after something's done, and you can actually say, oh, it's the characterisation, it's the writing, it's the one-liners, you know. When you're actually making it, you don't know it's going to have a legend, you know, quality later on. How did they know? How did they spot something that was different to everything else that was being made at the time?
I'm not sure they did. I think it was a happy accident, which it often is. The characters are well formed. They're very different. They've all got a comic line, a comic persona. And I think that they then the writers work on that, and established characters are developed and developed and developed, and that's how it happens.
It's quite a good line. I don't know if it's been on in this scene yet. I think it was early on where, I mean, Dad's Army is never rude, but Fraser has the line "Rollocks." You know, it's something for the parents who will understand it, but nothing offensive for the youngsters.
No.
And here we are. I don't know where this location was, but I seem to recall that you did a Coronation Street with people on a boat or a barge or something. What's it like filming out on? What would it be like with these guys out on this location here?
Incredibly difficult, because being on location, it'll probably be single camera, so all the movements of the oars have to correspond in every cut. So you can't cut off them when they're pulling back, and then come to find them still pulling back. So the continuity is a nightmare. But so this is obviously shot off another boat, because there'd be no room to get a camera in there. But the thing I did with on Coronation Street with a barge was it was like wearing it rather than shooting it, because it was so tiny, and trying to get the angle I wanted was a nightmare. We had to take windows out. We had to black it out. We had to then put all the windows back in again. Then we had to take seats out. We had to take to tease out just to get the camera in. So not easy, not easy.
Maybe they left one of their most demanding shoots until the very end of the series.
I suppose, you know, location budgets and things. But I'm wondering whether, because they did that location, that they did that bit of location filming, but then it goes more or less straight back to the studio. And I'm wondering whether that was a conscious decision or whether...
It might be. I mean, there were three different locations they used in this this episode. The one that you've just seen, where they were trying out the new boat, was the River Waveney in Beccles.
Oh, right.
I'm not quite sure where that is,
no,
to be honest with you. But there's two other pieces of location shooting later on, and I'll mention those if I remember when we get there. But I think you've always got the slight jar when you go from studio to location, and I guess it must be something to do with videotape and also film,
to do with exposure, because studio exposure is usually about f/2.8, whereas on location it can be f/22, and so therefore the depth of field is endless,
right?
It really jumps out at you.
And is that just the quality, or what's the difference between those two?
Well, it means that whereas with studio you get in on the faces and that's all in focus, and the background is lost,
right,
because the focus is so much shorter. But out on location it's very often, you know, f/22, and even then with filters, the quality is totally different.
Mm. It's something that I think was true to all television of that period, really, and certainly Doctor Who. We got obligatory references.
Yes, yes. There,
yes. And there's another one coming up later, which I'm looking forward to.
Oh yes, thanks very much.
This is studio.
Yeah,
this is definitely studio.
Yeah, and this is which I know you've had some experience with, CSO.
Yeah.
Which for our listeners is color separation overlay. So it's the blue screen process.
Yeah.
Have you ever worked with CSO?
Yes, I have, a couple of times. There was one occasion on Emmerdale when I had a dog that was shot, and the dog we had would lie down perfectly, but it wouldn't stop breathing, which was understandable, but very irritating. So what we did was we got the stills photographer who was on set to take a shot of the dog, and we then shot a piece of grass without the dog, and then took it into studio and put the two together.
Oh wow!
So the dog was definitely looking dead.
Yes.
The other one was we had a hot air balloon, and of course the unfortunate situation was that it was a very windy day, and I had a shot where the one of the actors, Amos Brearley, was put in the balloon and it flew away, and it was very important for the show to have that shot. And of course the balloon wouldn't behave, it banged into tents and it did all sorts of things, absolute nightmare. So again I got the stills photographer to take a shot of the balloon, and then we took it into studio, and using the empty frame I'd done of the parade ground, or of the grounds where the event was taking place, we then zoomed the balloon away.
Ah, so it looked like it was flying off.
Yeah, it looked like it was flying off.
I mean, it's presumably a very complex thing. Presumably the audience here are going to be looking at the actors on a blue set. They're not going to see all this here.
Oh, no.
But presumably there were monitors inside that they would see this image.
Yeah.
This is a really nice scenario, actually, because it is all the characters being... you know, I mean, you've got Wilson reading his magazine, not really paying much attention to anything. And Jonesy coming out with silly suggestions. Mannering trying to take over. Fraser sulking. It really is... and we should also reference Private Desmond, who's played by Desmond Cullum-Jones. He was one of the regular back row extras on the show. But I believe he appeared in every episode, Desmond Cullum-Jones. Normally, Colin Bean would step in and do this kind of thing, but for some reason, Colin Bean isn't in the second half of this series, season three. He doesn't crop up. I feel quite sorry for Desmond Cullen Jones, because he does have a line later on. They still don't credit him, which is such a shame when it's only an eight people in the entire.
Well, yeah, pretty much. I wonder whether or not he really was supposed to mention a line or something. I'm trying to remember what it was now. We'll talk about it when we see it. But I think that may be the only time any of the back line get a substantive, you know, contributing.
There's a nice line, moment. So. Nice moment here, Mervyn. Jimmy Beck is given a bit of praise here by Mannering as Walker. You worked with James Beck, didn't you?
I did, yes, in radio, in Leeds. He used to come up to do North Region dramas, and I met him then, and he was great fun. He was a very, very funny man, and he pretended to have a great affection for my wife, who was Alan Aitborn's PA on the shows, and every time he saw me, he'd say to Sue, my then wife, "Haven't you got rid of him yet?" But no, he was smashing. He was a great fun. A great shame he died so early.
That sounds like a very Walker line, actually, doesn't it? Not completely out of character.
Yeah. Did he have a lot of range as an actor? I mean, he wasn't a one-trick pony, presumably.
No, he wasn't. No, he did. I can't remember the shows we did with him, but he did quite a few plays for Al Aitborn, and he was quite adaptable. Yeah. You know, this wasn't his only performance.
Yeah. I think in all fairness, pretty much every one of the seven regulars, you know, did have a very, very wide range, and you got to see how good an actor they were throughout the course of Dad's Army, because at some point, even if it's only one or two episodes, you usually got them to see them acting outside the character's comfort zone. And, you know, you and I could probably name two or three episodes that where Mannering is shown in a very different light. You know, Mum's Army springs to mind. But the thing that I like about this scene, and you mentioned where Mannering was castigating James Beck's character a little bit, is the dynamic between Fraser and Mannering here. Because all of Mannering and Fraser's arguments happen with an audience. You very rarely get a two-hander. Now, you do with the other characters with Mannering. And it's very much a one-upmanship, and it's a showy relationship. Fraser wants to highlight Mannering's failings in public. If there wasn't an audience, he wouldn't bother doing it. And again, I think that shows consistency of writing.
Yes.
For Fraser's character.
Yeah, the captain when Fraser takes over the platoon for an episode. What's that episode called?
That's something about caps.
If a cap fits. Yeah, and Fraser and Mannering have that wonderful bagpipe gag.
Yeah.
That's one we should watch together. But yeah, you're quite right. Yes, Fraser, he likes to show Mannering up any time he can. The man's a fool, or, you know, it's all the references.
But he won't do it if it's just the two of them.
No.
He's actually quite supportive. The scenes that you've just got John Laurie and Arthur Lowe in are usually where Fraser is showing some kind of support. And it works with John Lemesurier as well. If you think of Getting the Bird, the scene that he has with with Wilson, about Wilson's daughter. One of those episodes we were just talking about takes Fraser outside of his comfort zone. He has a straight line, totally non-comedic in nature, the conversation, and it just shows how good the actors are. And that, for me, is something that you can watch Dad's Army and miss a lot of the time, and unless you actually watch all of the episodes. And I just think it's great. I think the claustrophobic environment of this episode is also very, very watchable, and I think that is down to the direction in part, because even whether they're in the real boat or whether they're in this mock-up in the studio, which has actually still got some camera shake on it, you can see Mannering's head going off the top of the screen. So and that might be the reason why the mixture between the CSO moving up and down in the background and the characters' heads going up and down, and they're slightly out of sync, aren't they?
Yes.
Maybe that's why I feel seasick myself when I watch this.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, these are very long scenes as well, aren't they? There's a lot of dialogue in here, a lot of magic. I mean, they really are this is almost like a live... You could imagine this on the stage, couldn't you?
Oh, yes.
If they were to adapt any more episodes of the stage, I think this could be a winner, really, because it's all... you know, you have a stage on a boat on the stage, you know.
Pulling up in France might be a bit difficult to
achieve. Yeah.
But aside from that, I think you're probably right. This is, I think, one of the closest character pieces that you get within Dad's Army, because you do get snapshots of each of the characters, but it's quite a claustrophobic feel it creates as well. And also, now I don't know about you, but as a viewer, I actually remember seeing this episode for the first time. I really believe they're pulled up in France.
Yeah.
Because you hear the singing in a second from, you know, the French singing. I was actually quite taken with it. I was thinking, what have they done in this episode? They've actually put these non-combatants, really, in... enemy territory, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite... I mean, for so early on, I suppose this is the furthest they've ventured, even inadvertently, by getting lost on their boat. But, yeah, this has got quite an epic feel to this story, and also because it feels like they're on a mission, you know? It feels like they're, you know, behind enemy lines, you know? It's quite... You know, even though it's preposterous.
Yes.
But, I mean, I mean, if this was a Lower Low, for example, a Lower Low would take a storyline and stretch it over four episodes. You know, they'd throw the Home Guard into France for like four episodes, you know. But here, Jimmy and David just do it for like 10, 15 minutes and you have your fun, and then next week you're going to have some different kind of fun. I think that's why Dad's Army feels a lot fresher than other wartime comedies, because they don't stretch a gag out for weeks and weeks and weeks. That's a nice, clever use of CSO. Just a very quick thing with the horizon and the background there in the studio. But here they are. You know, I like this in an episode. It gets the pace up as well. You know, they've got their rifles up ready. You don't know what's going to happen. Because, I mean, if you're in the army, you've got to have a bit of action in there every now and then, a bit of tension.
No, absolutely. I mean, there is some continuity throughout Dad's Army. Indeed, the characters are the biggest continuity elements, along with their catchphrases and so on. So you don't necessarily need a story to span two or three episodes to take the viewer with them. But you're certainly right about the pacing. Just to cut in, this is another location that I mentioned, and that's in Great Yarmouth Railway Stations.
All right.
It's actually the sidings of them. And when they pulled up, on the coast, it wasn't Calais. ironically, it was Lowestoft.
Oh, wonderful!
So yes, they did get about a little bit for this particular episode. And actually, I have a feeling that the sidings that I talked about may not necessarily have been Weymouth. I think that may be later on in the episode when they pull up in a station, but that could also be the studio. So. Mm. I'm sure someone will correct us, as per usual.
And for those Doctor Who fans out there who are used to our plug-in, well, this is one that's actually we're allowed to say, because the actor on the left, John Leeson, he's now very well known as the voice of K-9 in Doctor Who. So a nice little two-three lines in there as that soldier. Who is the other gentleman?
Jonathan Holt was the other actor. And as a question, actually, I wanted to ask Merv, and one of the things Perrin Croft did occasionally was to move the story on by having a scene with none of the regulars in it. And we've just seen one of those between John Leeson and Jonathan Holt. And again, that's the scene that you realise you're not in France. You're actually in Britain. Mm. But so all of a sudden, the way this is directed and the way it's been written, the audience is ahead of the characters. How easy is that to actually direct? Because you've got to try and create a convincing atmosphere for the characters, and yet the audience are in on the gag now.
Well, it's a double laugh, isn't it? Because, first of all, the audience find out that they're not in France, and then the anticipation of waiting for them to find out they're not in France is a double laugh.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's a good technique, and also it means you, as you say, you can move the story on. Because you've got the bridge without the main characters in it, so they can be doing all sorts of things because you can't see them, and it moves the tale along.
Mm. No, I think it must be interesting, you know, because you're trying to create the suspense all of a sudden, and within, I don't know, a very brief scene, it's gone, and you're back to comedy, and that must influence the way you direct it.
Yeah. Oh yes, sure. Yes. I mean, it's good that you've got the audience are one ahead of the characters sometimes.
Absolutely. I think with Dad's Army, that's normally the case, but it was unusual here. As I said earlier, it was very, very convincing. And we've got more use of chroma key here. And again, it's this is railway carriage here. And it's funny because there are so many examples of 60s, or predominantly 70s, and some 80s television where chroma key wasn't used successfully. Whereas within Dad's Army, there isn't a point where it will ever throw you out of the story. It's
no, you're quite right, actually. And I think here it does really work because it's the way they're using it isn't beyond your imagination. On shows like Doctor Who, where you've got to buy into the special effects as well as the fact that they're trying to achieve it on a low budget. Here, it's just a case where you've got a scene on a train, and we're seeing. I mean, you know, you're not. I think here you don't believe that they're on a moving train, but it tells the story that they're on a moving train. I think that's the difference. Where sometimes people are harsh on bad CGI, because you've got to believe that someone's on the moon or something, and it already looks that. But I mean, hell, now everyone's looking at the bulges in there.
This is the one thing I don't think works in this episode, because it's ridiculous. Yeah. It's gone over the line of being realistic and believable. The reason why they get away with it just about is because of how serious Mannerin takes it.
Yeah.
Look at him, he's addressing his troops in enemy territory. He doesn't know if he's going to see them alive again.
That's right.
Despite the fact they've got, you know, a jumper or a jacket up their stomach.
Yeah.
This up their jumper.
It reminds me of The Great Escape, this one, when they're all saying bye, they're all going to go and try and find a way home. And as I say, you could totally imagine this could have been a great one. If they were to adapt some of the Dad's Army scripts for film, I think this could have been one that they could easily have adapted for film because of the potential dramatic nature of it, but also, therefore, the potential comedy that could have happened if they were all, you know, I can imagine Wilson dealing with being trapped in Paris or somewhere in France a lot better than Mannering. You know, Mannering would have been rather flabbergasted. Wilson would have probably been chilling out in a nice cafe and
on
chatting up a waitress.
In a chaise
longue, yeah, absolutely.
No, I think so. we just had a point where the train stopped there and all of the cars jumped into each other. I mean, presumably that's is there someone on set, Merv, just saying now?
Yeah.
Or going like that and everybody...
Yeah, somebody would have queued that, yeah. Going back to your comment about CSO... Before they had CSO, the system was telecine was projected onto a screen at the back. If you remember some of the old episodes of Z cars, where they're driving the police cars along, and there's the most appalling background through the back window of the car, which was done by projecting film onto a screen at the back of the. At the back of the car,
and then filming it.
Yeah.
Wow! So yeah. Television on television.
So yeah. So yeah. Things have improved since then.
Yes,
absolutely. Oh, there's no question. I mean, this works even today. It's not convincing, and you can tell that it's not real. But at the same time, it doesn't take you out of the story. And we've just seen. We've just seen the realisation dawn that they're in Eastbourne.
Yeah, and now they're
a very, very clipped English gent speaking French. So
and they've got to go back and pick up their rifle.
Perhaps
bolt.
This is the shot along Weybourne sidings.
Yeah.
This book that I'm using as a reference guide is not particularly clear, knowing that the author will be listening. Anyway, there we go. And then the end credits roll. So on the whole, I know we've been talking about this from a slightly different point of view this time, because we've been looking at the direction and production a lot more than we usually do. But what would you say? Good episode on it?
I think it's a very, very strong episode. It's not slapstick heavy, so it's obviously a favourite with you. It's a very strong one, and it focuses more or less entirely on the platoon and as a team rather than on any individual characters, and they all get a good laugh in there. Yeah, what do you think, Merv?
I think it's an excellent episode. I mean, it covers a large area, apparently, and it works very successfully. I think it's very convincing.
Well, Ollie, Merv, thanks very much indeed for joining me once again. In your case, Oliver, once again.
Yeah.
to discuss, yes, what is one of my favourite episodes of Dad's Army.
Yeah. Bye for now.
This is Frank Williams, and you're listening to the Dad's Army podcast.
Hello there, Mervyn. I was wondering if you could just tell me how you came to meet Frank Williams.
Well, I first met Frank when we were doing a show called Tanner. and he came up to York to do a part of Prothero, who was the local big Mr. Nasty, and that's when I first met him.
Great, and then could you explain how you came to direct his documentary?
Well, that was through Ollie Crocker, who invited me to do it, and I was very happy to do it because it was such a fascinating subject. We were given completely free rein of his house with all his amazing pictures and memorabilia, and we took him up to his old stamping ground, the old location, and filmed him up there as well.
What's the subject matter to Murder by Appointment?
Murder by Appointment is a play about a murder which takes place in the north of Yorkshire, which was one of his plays, which we adapted a part of for television. And Frank very kindly came up onto location and was very good because he advised us on the show itself.
What's Frank like to work with as an actor?
Oh, he's brilliant. I mean, he is so consistent. He's so inventive. He's so focused on what he's doing that every take is absolutely identical to the one before. And yet he takes direction beautifully.
What do you enjoy about working with Frank? And what strikes you about Frank as a character, as a person?
Well, Frank as a character is very, very laid back and a very gentle man. But he's got an amazing brain, and he did all the work we've done this week, completely off the top of his head. He thought through the whole story. We have to shoot out a sequence, obviously, in television, but he kept a consistency in his performance right the way through, which was brilliant.